Greetings and welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. I am this week's producer, Jeremy Roth Kushel. I speak with Kirby Summers, author of books like Jeffrey Epstein, Predator Spy, and Ghislaine Maxwell, An Unauthorized Biography, and an advocate for victims of sex trafficking, about what the deep political background of espionage not covered in the upcoming Ghislaine Maxwell trial can tell us about the U.S.-Israel special relationship and government by blackmail, hoping to further understanding Israel-Palestine beyond the walls. This is Jeremy Roth Kushel with Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. I'm very pleased to be joined by Kirby Summers, who is an author and an advocate. She has written many, many books of crucial importance, including Jeffrey Epstein, Predator Spy, Jeffrey Epstein Revealed, Ghislaine Maxwell, An Unauthorized Biography. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kirby Summers.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy. I've been looking forward to our chat.
Me too. Kirby, I'd like to start out by pointing out that the case of Ghislaine Maxwell, which is coming to a head in New York next month, is usually covered as a salacious, quote-unquote, high society account of gossip in corporate media and even parts of the independent media. But this deeper espionage background of her case and relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and the networks that they worked with and for and amongst is related to the background of Ghislaine's father, Robert Maxwell, the infamously known Israel super spy. And this deeper background is something that you cover in your book, Ghislaine Maxwell, An Unauthorized Biography. Can you give us some background in regards to the blackmail network parameters of the Robert Maxwell network, and then more generally his role as Israel super spy and how that relates then to his daughter?
I want to preface this by stating that, as you've noticed, as probably everyone who's interested in the Ghislaine Maxwell case noticed, which you accurately state is scheduled to commence on November 29th, so next month, just a few weeks from today, is a case that mainstream media has not described at any point in time as belonging to an intelligence network, blackmail. They're only really looking at four individual victims and two counts of perjury. I think that if people are not really looking at this case on a regular basis, they would be inclined to believe that we're tackling, by we meaning the United States' current case against Ghislaine Maxwell, the whole thing. But we're not. The espionage angle of it is not being covered. The blackmail, and you and I had a previous conversation where we discussed the fact that there was also financial crimes that were committed by Epstein that linked back to Michael Milken and Leon Black. None of that other stuff is going to be covered, nor is it covered. With regard to the blackmail operation, I also want to make it very clear that it did not begin with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, that this is the way our government runs. Our government is run by blackmail prior to the Epstein case, which we were never supposed to see. This sort of popped up in Palm Beach close to 15, 20 years ago. It was supposed to be squashed. Alexander Acosta made that infamous statement. I was told to back off. Epstein was given a slap on the wrist. It disappeared. Mainstream media at the time described the victims as prostitutes, as drug addicts, made them out to be the perpetrator as opposed to the victim, which is pretty much what we saw during the Franklin scandal.
Kirby, can you explain what the Franklin scandal is? And I just want to highlight that the crucial piece you bring to the table here is an understanding of the reality of deep politics, and that government, both here and abroad, and most especially in terms of this program, the quote-unquote special relationship between the United States and Israel, is not driven by surface-level politics, but driven by what has been titled the deep state or deep politics, which is defined by the dean of modern deep politics, academic Peter Dale Scott, as the merger or the intersection of the national security apparatus, most especially intelligence networks and espionage espionage combined in a synergistic fashion with the underground economy and organized crime, and that this is the real governance that we live under, the government of and by blackmail. So can you explain the background of this domestic case of child abuse and how it might be related to this government by blackmail in terms of the Franklin scandal?
Yes, absolutely. There was a very well-known place called Boys Town in Nebraska. And Boys Town was made famous in the very old Hollywood movies. And it was Father Flanagan. And at the end of all of these shows would be send money to Boys Town because this is where we rescue the homeless and the boys that don't have any homes. So I think this began in the 1930s, although we only know about the cases that were brought to the forefront in the 1980s. The Franklin scandal was obtaining boys, but also girls, because at some point it also became a home for girls, and flying them to Washington, D.C., where they would be at these parties. And I'm using air quotes here when I use the term parties. The children would be kept in another part of the home. After the party was over, there would be some people that lingered because they knew that they were going to be, and I hate to use this term, but this is the term that they would use, treats. They would be granted party favors. These party favors came in the form of children that were, prior to the party, provided with drugs like cocaine, any kind of drug. The drugs were passed around, as were the children. The children were horribly abused. You can't call this sex. This is just horrific torture at these parties. And what's interesting is that any of us can actually look for a mainstream media article, and it's called White House Call Boy Ring. And it talks about the fact that these, quote, call boys, come on, you're not of age to give consent. It's a child trafficking network, but that's what they were called, that they were given the opportunity to have access to the White House at midnight with another character named Craig Spence, who I also discuss in my book, Jeffrey Epstein, Predator Spy, because he is very much a character like Jeffrey Epstein. We have many of these characters. We have Jeffrey Epstein, Craig Spence. We have the Franklin scandal, which Craig Spence was connected with. Roy Cohn was also connected to the Franklin scandal. Someone who was very similar to Leslie Wexner. His name was Alan Bear. Alan Bear was a very wealthy and powerful owner of a department store. Not one, but like Wexner had Victoria's Secret. Alan Bear had many department stores and made his fortune like that. He was one of the prominent men who was outed. And if you try to look for anything Alan Bear, B-A-E-R, you'll be hard pressed to find him connected to the Franklin scandal. What would happen with this information is that it allowed for the manipulation of our government. It indicated who's going to take office, what that person who is holding office is going to do. In order to make this case go away, when it actually ended up in front of a judge, the children were basically told, you will have to say that you were lying. And if you don't say you were lying, we're going to put you in jail. One girl refused, Alicia Owen refused, and she in fact was put in jail. She spent 2 years in solitary confinement, another number of years in jail. So a lot of these children who have been caught in these intelligence and politically connected trafficking rings don't get as far as we have gotten with the Jeffrey Epstein case. We are at a rare moment in time. We were not supposed to see this, and the victims who are speaking were never supposed to be heard. So this is a window that we have to take advantage of and learn as much as we can about how government really works.
Leslie Wexner, who you brought up, is crucial to our inquiry here in terms of understanding Israel-Palestine beyond the walls. He is part of a group of Zionist billionaires who are very politically powerful, who have titled themselves the mega group. And they include people like Leslie Wexner, the Bronfmans, who sit at the commanding heights of things like Birthright Israel trips, but also Hillel, Leslie Wexner sits on the board of Hillel, an organization alleged to be promoting Jewish life around the country, around the world. It has chapters on university campuses. It also includes the dean of the Birthright Israel program at some point, Michael Steinhardt, whose father was a jewel fence for the Meyer Lansky organized crime syndicate. But then specifically, Leslie Wexner is the long-term patron of Deborah Lipstadt, who is the current guru of the quote-unquote new anti-Semitism and has picked up where former Israeli minister Natan Sharansky left off, collapsing the well-known traditional understanding of what anti-Semitism is as specifically anti-Jewish bias, and then layering on top of it this entire power, geopolitics, state apparatus of Israeli politics. And Deborah Lipstadt has been funded by Wexner and his foundation for many years. And then one last thing with Wexner in terms of understanding Israel-Palestine beyond the walls is that it was Wexner who led the way in hiring Frank Luntz, the notorious GOP guru of spin, basically known as a pollster, one of the proteges of Arthur Finkelstein, who actually helped bring Netanyahu into power as prime minister the first time around in 1996. Wexner hired Luntz in the immediate wake of the launch of the American-Iraq War in 2003 that was very largely driven by the power politics of the Israel lobby, as explained in Chapter 8 of The Israel Lobby by Mearsheimer and Walt, where Luntz was hired by Wexner to specifically take on the propaganda, the PR inquiry into how to pitch the Iraq War as in American interests and not associated with Israeli interests.
You've done a good job explaining what Wexner has done and his role. But I do want to insert a caveat here. Sometimes, let's say if you're working undercover, the name of something, in this case, the mega group, will be thrown into the mix to confuse people. So in my book, Jeffrey Epstein, Predator Spy, I devote a whole chapter as to how that word came to be and why it's a screen, a camouflage. But nevertheless, there are a group of people. They're not necessarily, from my understanding, called the mega group, because I know that Meshulam Rickliss was part of it. Ira Rickliss was part of it. And I never heard them discuss it or refer to it as, quote, the mega group. I believe that was just some smoke to cover up the fact that there was a spy, codename Mega, inside of Bill Clinton's White House. And that made the news and it was immediately removed. A year later, suddenly there was an article, I believe it was a planted article, discussing that Leslie Wexner and Samuel Brofman and Steven Spielberg had a group that would benefit Israel. And it was called Mega. But I think that was just to throw off the scent of Mega the spy, who, in fact, I'm going to reveal before we are done with this conversation.
Gordon Thomas, who's a co-author of the book Robert Maxwell, Israel Super Spy, his book Gideon Spies, The Secret History of the Mossad, has a section that talks about the mega intercept during the Clinton administration. High-level Israeli officials in the United States were caught on NSA intercept saying, we don't use mega for that. This is the same Clinton administration that was shown to have a relation with Epstein and Maxwell many years earlier, and the same Clinton administration where the White House had certain telecommunications contracting done by an Israeli military intelligence firm called Converse Infosys.
It's important to understand that Bill Clinton's White House had three Israeli telephone firms that had set up his telephone system. One would have to immediately wonder why there wasn't an American company that would wire the White House. Why were there three, not one even, but three, that belonged to Israel? And of course, they're going to intercept. There was a letter. Israel wanted the letter. They referred to Mega the spy during this intercepted phone call. Let's contact Mega the spy. And of course, Mega is the code name for this mole in the White House? And the answer was, as you said, that's not what we use MEGA for. And so this became an article, I believe in 1998 or 1997, but simultaneous to the conversation that was intercepted, the FBI did commence an investigation. What did Bill Clinton do? Bill Clinton put a kibosh on the investigation. He did not let them investigate to find out who MEGA the spy was. A year after that initial article that was then never discussed again, another article sprang up saying, oh, MEGA, the group with Leslie Wexner and all of the other names. And since then, we've had another interpretation for the word MEGA. There's a MEGA agency that took, for example, the photograph of Ghislaine Maxwell at the In-N-Out Burger. And so the changes of the word MEGA are now three. But what we also have to remember is that Robert Maxwell had a very close friend, commencing from, I believe their friendship began in the 1950s, Samuel Pissar. Samuel Pissar is a French-born Zionist who was Robert Maxwell's lifelong confidant, and he became John F. Kennedy's advisor back in the 1960s. It brings us to present day because he has a stepson who has been selected by Joe Biden as the Secretary of State, namely Antony Blinken. And Leah Pazar worked for Bill Clinton as well as Antony Blinken. And I believe Leah Pazar is MEGA. Samuel Pissar was so lifelong Maxwell's confidant that he was the very last person Maxwell had a phone conversation with on November 5th, 1991, before he fell or was pushed off the Lady Ghislaine yacht. And it was to Samuel Pissar that Betty Maxwell, the grieving widow, although as a side note, they were getting ready to be divorced. So how much of a grieving widow, I don't know. But let's just assume she was the grieving widow, turns to Samuel Pissar, who goes ahead and makes that arrangement for that grand, over-the-top funeral fit for the head of a state, as if he were the prime minister who had just died.
Describe that scene, the funeral of Robert Maxwell, and why it's important to understanding who he actually was, if you would.
During that extravagant funeral in Israel, the people who attended were six serving and former heads of the Mossad, as well as former and present prime ministers, including Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon, and Shimon Peres. Also in attendance was the Soviet emigre, Nathan Sharansky. Once they put the body into the grave, the former prime minister, Shimon Peres, he steps forward and he looks at Betty Maxwell. And in a very loud and firm voice, after he gives a couple of other words of comfort, says the following thing about Robert Maxwell. He says, he has done more for Israel than can be told today. In Betty Maxwell's book and in Robert Maxwell, Israel's Super Spy by Gordon Thomas and Martin Dillon, they describe that as a tell. That was the acknowledgement by Israel that, in fact, Maxwell had been a spy for them.
What was the contribution of Robert Maxwell in an espionage fashion to the Israeli state in terms of nuclear secrets and promise software? It's well known now that the cultivation of its own nuclear program was one of the highest aspirations of the early Israeli state leaders, including Ben-Gurion, and even the aforementioned Shimon Peres, who became a prime minister, was one of the fathers of the Israeli nuclear program under what was known as LACOM, the Bureau of Scientific Relations. Ultimately, Shimon Peres then tasked the now infamous billionaire Israeli producer Arnon Milchan, who produced the film JFK by Oliver Stone, to become an agent of Israeli military intelligence, specifically nuclear technology. But Robert Maxwell was an integral part of this specific thread of Israeli espionage around weaponry and most intensely of nuclear technology. Kirby, will you explain the promise incident in terms of Robert Maxwell and the U.S. nuclear laboratories?
Robert Maxwell was approached by Rafi Eitan and Ariel Sharon and also Meshulam Ricklis in 1982. And what they wanted from him was for him to take on the task of selling Promise, which was stolen from Inslaw, a company owned by Bill and Nancy Hamilton. I've had the great fortune of being able to, in fact, interview Bill Hamilton about Promise. Promise was stolen away from Bill and Nancy Hamilton by the Department of State, by the CIA, and the Mossad, who then re-engineered it. It was like a tool that's very much like a Google for internal use. It was able to track people, and it had several functions. It could track people. It could track banking transactions. It could almost track, with a little tweaking of the software, almost anything you wanted it to track. So it was perfect for spying. Robert Maxwell was given this contract to go sell a compromised version of the Promise software to Sandia Laboratories. The way that he got an in was he went and he bribed then Senator John Tower, who was getting ready to retire from Texas, gave him $200,000, put on the record as a consultation fee. Tower turned around and basically said to him that sure, for that consultation fee on an annual basis, he would open the doors to anywhere that Maxwell wanted entry to. So although Maxwell had other avenues for entry into the White House, Tower made it possible for him to walk into Ronald Reagan's White House whenever he wanted. And it was known by William Webster at the time that it was John Tower who allowed Maxwell into Sandia Laboratories. Now, two scientists thought there was something peculiar about this guy, even though this guy walked in there and basically gave a who's who of the people he knew, including Ronald Reagan, and he threw around the names of the powerful men in the world that he knew. So some of them went along with it, but two of the scientists felt uncomfortable. They called the FBI. The FBI began an investigation. Now we have to then travel back into time. The FBI for 37 years, I believe, was run and started by J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover had always been heavily compromised. CIA has always had a connection with the mob, told them, get me some dirt on Hoover. And they were able to produce incriminating photographs of J. Edgar Hoover having private moments with his second in command, Clyde Tolson, in addition to boys, children from another trafficking ring run by Roy Cohn, where he would cross-dress and take advantage of these minor boys at the Plaza Hotel, which, by the way, would be later owned by Donald Trump, another figure that we see interconnect with Robert Maxwell's world and Jeffrey Epstein's world. The FBI investigation was shuttered. Now, William Webster at the time had the information. What happens when you have somebody of J. Edgar Hoover's stature compromised is that it compromises the entire agency for a very long time. Even though Hoover had been eyeing Maxwell suspiciously since the 1950s and always thought he was a Russian spy, he never did anything when he was in office. And nobody ever did anything afterwards either, because it was too much. But to show you how the intelligence agencies work, John Tower, in April of 1991, dies in a freak airplane accident. A few months before, Robert Maxwell, in November of 5th of 1991, falls or was pushed off his yacht. Intelligence agencies tend not to want to leave witnesses, so eventually they get you.
I think you're right to point to the apparent liquidation of John Tower and then Robert Maxwell, one by air, the other by sea, apparently. But I just want to point out that the proof is in the pudding about the compromise of J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the FBI for decades. As you said, the evidence was there to suspect Robert Maxwell of being an agent of espionage, and Hoover basically does nothing about it. And then also, Hoover is the source of the denial that there was even the existence of something such as organized crime. At the same time as people like Meyer Lansky were gathering together these forces and were involved in deep politics, including support of the early and proto-Israeli state, even in terms of trucking and bartering in weapons to that new state.
I've studied this for years beyond the second arrest of Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein's world, his connection to Leslie Wexner, his connection to people who intersect with Ghislaine Maxwell's life, shows us that the trafficking network is much broader. And what Bill Hamilton, who created Promise, told me in an interview is that it is his understanding that Epstein got a copy of Promise from Robert Maxwell and that it was used to keep track of the victims. I'm going to call them victims for the intelligence agency. I got that from Bill Hamilton. So if one needs, let's say, Promise, which was the precursor to PRISM, to keep track of these trafficked victims, does that not indicate to you that it is a much bigger operation than what mainstream media has led us to believe?
Very much so. And if this conversation is about government by blackmail, maybe next time we can talk about the technology of blackmail, which is what you're beginning to hint directly at, I would say, is if you're running a compromised network, then how do you keep track of it in relationship to surveillance technology? And that we are all in many ways being inserted into this kind of environment, and the specific technological aspirations of this network do go beyond just the intense desire of Maxwell's handlers inside of the Israeli state to acquire nuclear technology and continue into the contemporary cyber era in terms of the domination of global cyber technology, which would include Ghislaine Maxwell's current husband, Scott Borgerson, the founder of Cargo Metrics, which he titled as the NSA of freight, of shipping, of cargo metrics, and the heavy investor is Idan and Eyal Ofer, the majority owners of the Israel Corporation, which comes out of the early days of the State of Israel and controls certain companies such as Zim Shipping. There's a whole tie in there in terms of Zim Shipping pulling out of their long-term lease in the World Trade Center in the immediate run-up to the terrorist acts, which is one of the apparent pieces of evidence pointing towards, at the very least, certain high-level Israeli foreknowledge of those terrorist acts. The fact that Ghislaine Maxwell is married to Scott Borgerson and Cargo Metrics, along with all these other aspects in terms of her sisters and their involvement in Silicon Valley in a very close tie between the United States and Israeli high tech, shows that there's an aspiration here in terms of technology, I would assert, of blackmail too.
You're 100% right. I mean, technology that we have in our United States agencies do come from the Maxwell family. And if we call 911, what do we have? Ehud Barak's carbine 911, so that we're already past that point. Obviously, mainstream media doesn't cover that, but we're past that point. We have been taken over.
This is Jeremy Roth-Couchot with Understanding Israel-Palestine and Beyond the Walls. I've been speaking with author and advocate Kirby Summers. Kirby, can you give our audience a sense of where they can find more of your work?
Anyone can find me on Twitter. I try to put as much information on my Twitter, which is at Kirby Summers, K-I-R-B as in boy, Y as in yellow, S-O-M-M-E-R-S. My information with links to my podcast are on my website, again, kirbysummers.com, as well as a full list of my books, well over a dozen, a lot of them on Epstein. And I also have an Epstein Project newsletter. And Jeremy, I want to thank you for inviting me on your show. You're very enlightened and I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you so much, Kirby, for joining us. And I very much appreciate your work and your time with us today. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.